This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 24th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open session for Thursday, May 24th, 2012 will now come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for May 10th, 2012. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the minutes for the meeting of May 10th, 2012 as set forth in agenda document number 12-37.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. We have a few late submitted documents. Is there a motion?
Just a few. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-36, 12-36A, 12-39, 12-38. I think that's all I got right now.
Okay.
We might have another one later.
Might have one more. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Excellent. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-15, American Physical Therapy Association. Mr. Bloom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Commission has before it two documents, Agenda Document Number 12-36 and Agenda Document Number 12-36A. Agenda Document Number 12-36 is a draft response to a request for an advisory opinion from the American Physical Therapy Association, an incorporated membership organization. The requester asks whether the Act and Commission regulations permit it to solicit its members who work at corporations wholly or partly owned by APTA members for contributions to its SSF, and to have the corporations collect and transmit those contributions to APTA's SSF through payroll deduction. APTA would pay the corporations for their services. The draft concludes that, based on the facts and representations provided, APTA may implement its proposal without violating the prohibition on the making or acceptance of corporate contributions and without violating the prohibition on corporate facilitation of the making of contributions, so long as APTA pays the corporations in advance for the value of their services. Agenda Document Number 12-36A, designated Draft B, is substantively identical to Agenda Document Number 12-36 in that it arrives at the same conclusion and contains the same analysis. It differs in form, however, in order to track more closely the questions presented by the requester. We received no comments on the request or on either draft. In the event that the Commission votes to approve either draft, we also request the authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I was the instigator of Draft B, which is confusingly labeled Agenda Document 12-36A. We got to work on that numbering system. The original draft that OGC prepared was fine and answered the questions and addressed the issues that were presented by the request. But I like to answer the questions as they're asked. And so we just asked them to reformat it so that it would more closely track, as counsel said, the way the questions were presented in the request. Because I think requesters have the right to ask the questions in their own way, and we ought to try and answer them in the way that they've asked them. So if that's, I have a slight preference for Draft B, but if people don't want to do it that way, I would probably still vote for Draft A.
Motion.
I make a motion? Try it.
I'm more than happy to support Draft B if you make that motion.
All right. I'm going to go for it then. Which is Agenda Document A, just to be completely clear, right? I move approval of the response to the American Physical Therapy Association Advisory Opinion 2012-15 as set forth in Draft B, which is Agenda Document 12-36A. Along with technical and conforming amendments, authorization for council.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-17, Red Blue T, LLC. And with us today, we have Mr. Craig Engel and Mr. Brett Capel. Please welcome us at the table. Join us at the table.
Morning.
Morning. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We'll start with Mr. Lutz, who has a presentation from the Office of General Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda Document 12-39 contains two draft advisory opinions that respond to a request filed by Red Blue Tea, Armor Media, and MCUBE. MCUBE is a corporate aggregator of business-to-consumer messaging and merchant billing for wireless service providers and proposes to provide its services as an aggregator to process contributions made to political committees via text messaging. The requesters ask whether the proposal complies with the forwarding, record-keeping, and reporting provisions of the Act and satisfies the segregation requirements for commercial vendors that process political contributions. Draft A concludes that MCUBE's factored payments would comply with the prohibition on corporate contributions but would not satisfy the forwarding, record-keeping, and reporting and segregation requirements of the Act. Draft B concludes that the proposal satisfies the Act and Commission regulations. The Commission received 4 comments on the request and 3 comments on the proposed drafts. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Lutz, could you tell us the comments, just the organization or the entity that sent them in? I just want to make sure I have all of them because we're getting them in. So some of them just came in, I believe, this morning.
The comments on the drafts you're referring to?
Yes.
We received comments from the Obama for America Committee, the Romney for President Committee, and Aristotle.
Thank you. I do have them all. Excellent. Any questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me just state up front, we had scheduled this a meeting in advance of the last meeting that we would have to vote on it and still comply with our 60-day time limit because we thought we might need some time to talk with you. I personally am not really prepared to, I want to find out some more about the proposal, and I'm not prepared to vote today on either draft. So I haven't made up my mind. I'm sort of in information gathering mode because it's kind of a complicated proposal. So if you could start off by explain to me factoring. How does this work?
Sure. Well, first of all, I do want to say at the beginning how much I want to compliment your Office of General Counsel in working with me over the last couple of months in both helping me frame this advisory opinion request and going back and forth with them and making sure that the questions were presented in such a way that were very easy to understand. This request could not have been made any more clear, to the extent that it is clear, without the help of your office, so I do appreciate that quite a bit. Factoring is a setting in which a corporation like MCUBE or many other corporations in different industries are going to take an estimation of the amount of proceeds that any particular commercial or political fundraising affair would bring in and interpret what a likely collection amount of that fundraising will be over a period of time and take a factor of that, a percentage of that, and give that to the customer in anticipation of those collections then coming in. Essentially, it is quite similar to a credit card processing where an individual may make a charge on their credit card on day one. On day four, the recipient political committee would get the proceeds of that charge. On day 30, you know, the credit card would bill the customer. On day 50, the customer would pay the credit card. So a factor in the texting scenario would be very similar to a credit card company giving a share of a charge quite quickly after the charge is made.
Well, does the credit card company give a share? The credit card company gives the whole amount, don't they?
Well, they take out a percentage of,
their fee.
Right.
But this is set up a little bit differently because they're going to convey most but not all of the amount?
Right. That's to protect against a corporate contribution from being made because they don't want to over-advance any amount of money that may not otherwise be collected.
Okay, so how does the... All right, so it's how does... All right, break it up into the two payments and explain how each of them complies with the 10-day forwarding requirement.
Well, I think that you would look at it in the following way. On any given 10-day period where opt-ins are being made and a total amount of money from opt-ins is being estimated, let's say, hypothetically, $100,000 of opt-ins is going to be made in a particular week. What an aggregator will do is take a look at the total number of opt-ins and forward a factor of that to the political committee. And then, after that factored amount has been sent, then see how the collections come in and then make good on any amount held back to make sure that the political committee customer or the corporate customer receives exactly the amount of contributions that they have been pledged minus fees.
Okay, so there's two separate payments, though. So how do each one of those payments, there's the upfront, the bulk of it is going to go out as earlier, and then there's the
trailing
payment?
Mm-hmm. Or better said, Commissioner, maybe a reconciliation.
Okay.
I think maybe the best way to put it is that the initial payment or payments that could be happening weekly would be, let's say hypothetically, 75% of the amount of money that's being pledged or opted in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every 30 days, again on a weekly basis, the data aggregator is going to see how the collections are coming in and make a reconciliation of the amount of money that they also then owe their customer. So it's designed to be kind of an ongoing calculation to make sure of two things. First of all, that the political committee customer gets the contributions to which they are entitled. But secondly, that the data aggregator does not over advance any money so that it would be viewed that a political committee is getting money that it shouldn't be entitled to. This is very, very common both in charitable texting and in commercial texting, where customers, whether they be charities or for-profit entities, are interested in receiving as much of their proceeds as quickly as possible. Aggregators are prepared to do that so long as that they don't risk their own money.
I get that. What I'm trying to figure out is we've got a requirement in our law which is different from, you know, there's a business practice that might make perfect sense in the business world and in the charitable world, but we've got to try and figure out how it works given the confines of our statute, which says you have to forward the contributions within 10 days. So what would you say is the date from which the 10-day obligation starts running?
Say that again, please.
The statute requires that contributions be forwarded within 10 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the date? What is the action that you believe triggers that, starts that 10-day clock running? Is it when the pledge is made? Is it when the payment to the credit card company is made on the bill, or the phone company, rather, on the bill? Is it, what starts the 10-day clock running? Because there's got to be something that starts the 10-day
right.
clock running.
Well, fortunately, there are a lot of different ways to look at it. One of the ways in which we proposed the commission look at it in our advisory opinion request was in the form of, like, a sale of assets, which is, I think, a very clear additional way to take a look at how factoring could be analyzed. The second
Let
thing is...
Let me interrupt you for a second mm-hmm. there on that one. So if it's a sale of assets, then who owns the asset at the time that it is conveyed to the political committee?
Brett, would you like to answer that part?
Yes. If it is a sale of assets, the contribution is made at the time that the pledge is made, and then it is a legal obligation of the original contributor to the political committee.
No. What I'm asking, though, is, I mean, because one concern I had with that theory was if it's a sale of assets, And don't get me wrong. I'm trying to find a way to get to
the
result. Okay, mm-hmm. Because I read the comments. I agree with the principle that this would be a good thing. It's a good small d democratizing goal to try and advance small donor participation in the system. That's a good goal, and we should be trying to help advance that. So I'm just trying to figure out what the best path is and how to get there. So if the aggregator, the factor, buys the assets, at that point, when it then conveys it to the political committee,
The contributor makes the contribution to the political committee.
Okay.
Then it becomes a receivable to the political committee.
Okay.
The factor buys the receivable from the political committee.
Okay.
Gives them a percentage, a factor of that amount upfront. Until the entire collection process can work through on the phone bill. And then they make the trailing payments to reconcile the commercial transaction between the aggregator and the political committee at the end.
Okay, so at what point does it become the asset of the political committee such that it can be?
When the pledge is made.
When the pledge is made. But then isn't the trailing payment going to come in later, more than 10 days after?
It will, but it's not a contribution. It's an asset. It's not the money does not flow through directly through this transaction in a time period. What happens is the pledge is an asset. The pledge is sold to the aggregator who pays for it. And then there are two payments for that pledge, the initial payment and then the trailing payment. So what the sale of assets argument does is you avoid the entire 10-day period because you're not actually forwarding a contribution. You're exchanging a pledge of a contribution for an asset.
Clever. All right. I it wasn't clear to me from reading it exactly who the asset was being acquired from.
Right.
All right. So the political committee owns it but then what if the pledge isn't made good on? So they can't own something that doesn't actually exist.
Well, they own it. The aggregator is agreeing contractually with the political committee to accept the risk that they may not be able to collect the actual amount of money. That's why they only pay them a factor up front, so that they can protect against the fact that the original contributor may renege. And that's exactly how it works with charitable organizations and for-profit organizations who they're paying for the time value of money. We won't accept the full amount we're due for a period of time, but as long as we get most of it up front. And that's exactly how the charities work, because this process started in response to emergencies where there was an immediate need for funds in Haiti. That's how it stopped. And the factoring is a way to get those funds to the organization that contracts for this process right away. That's how you satisfy the overall goal of the statute of the contribution being in the hands of the political committee within 10 days. I mean, the contribution is made when the pledge is made, and the campaign has the majority of those funds, a representative amount of those funds within 10 days, even though it's a commercial transaction, not an actual flow through of the actual contribution money from the individual to the campaign.
And if the donor reneges later, there will be a reconciliation that takes that money out, even though the
right
factor is assuming the risk of non-payment. In fact, they're not entirely assuming the risk of non-payment, because the money has to, the political committee has to give back the money if it. If
right.
The donor,
well, there are several safeguards built into the process to protect the factor's financial interest against reneging, and they can adjust the percentage of the factor to reflect experience with specific campaigns and contributors.
Now, we don't normally, we've got a regulation that says that a contribution is made when it, leaves the, when the contributor sort of let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you reconcile this pledge theory, saying, well, it's actually when the pledge is made, it's not when the contributor actually transfers the money?
Well, when the individual pledges the contribution, they're doing it through their phone bill. So they have a contractual obligation to pay their phone bill. So they lost control of the contribution at the time that they enter into that contractual agreement.
Would that then also govern all, would we have to read that back into our credit card rules also, that when somebody makes the charge, that's when the, are we going to then force all credit card companies to develop a factor relationship with somebody in order to not violate the 10-day rule, because we normally, you know, would say it's when the money leaves the contributor's hands? I don't want to be advancing the 10-day trigger for everybody else.
Well, remember, in a credit card situation, again, if an individual makes a charge of, let's say, $10 to a political committee on, let's say, day one, by around day four, the political committee has received that amount of money, less fees. And that's because the money moves that quickly. The money has not been collected. It hasn't even been billed to the donor, to the charger. So remember, on day one, someone makes a charge of, let's say, $10 to a political committee. On day four, that political committee is probably going to be receiving $9.80 or $9.50. But it isn't until, like, day 30 that the credit card company generates a statement to the person who made the charge for that $10. And then it isn't until, like, day 50 that that person then pays their credit card bill. So the analogy here is quite apt in terms of how the money moves in what share at what time, from the time in which a person opts in through text or makes a charge on a credit card. Pretty similar.
Well, but I don't think we have interpreted the credit card rules in that way, that, you know, at the time you, you know, make the pledge, so to speak, before you paid the bill, that it, well, I think it's when the card is swiped. I think that's what the precedent is. So it's, is that analogous or not? What I'm trying to make sure is, can I, you know, here's the big picture question. Can I say yes to you without having ripple effects that are going to affect how we analyze numerous other situations where I don't believe the commission has stated that pledges constitute the trigger for the 10-day requirement?
Commissioner, the way I would put it is, if you don't say yes here, it'll have ripple consequences for what's going on in many other ways.
If a credit card contribution is considered to be made when the credit card is swiped, that's exactly the same as considering a pledge to be made when it's texted. The actual money from the original person doesn't wind up getting paid until months later, but the campaign committees have access to that money within a number of days, so it's very similar.
Okay. One thing that I'm going to sort of switch gears here, one thing that I was a little unclear on was exactly what your disclaimer, what in the last time we looked at this, we had some very specific list of messages that, you know, will you certify this, will you certify that, and I'm a little unclear on what your protections are going to be, the exact language that you're going to use to ensure that people are certifying that they're doing everything they're legally able to give and everything is going to comply with law.
Sure. A contribution can be made via texting in essentially two ways. One, by reading off of a website, and one by just working with your mobile device. When you're looking at a website and then choosing to make a contribution through your mobile phone after looking on a website, the attestations will be identical.
The same ones that CTIA listed?
The same that are on any.
Yes. In case somebody's listening to the tape,
yes.
Can I ask you for a verbal answer? So you're saying that they will be, because you just nodded.
Yes.
They will be the same attestations that were listed in the CTIA request.
Here's the way I would like to answer that. First of all, if you're going to be making a contribution via texting, and you're doing that through looking at a candidate's website, and you're going to hit donate now, and you'll be given the option of donating through a credit card or using your mobile device to make a contribution, those attestations will be identical to the attestations that are currently on all of these campaigns' websites. So there will be no difference there. The other question is, if you are only using your mobile device, then what will happen is, on your mobile device, before you can make your donation, you will have to reply yes to the amount of questions or the amount of inquiries in other attestations. You'll just be seeing it on your screen.
But it'll be the same list of questions. Right. Hmm. And you have to say yes, 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 yes.
I don't think that we're going to be saying yes, 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 yes sequentially. One of the things from the DSCC advisory opinion from last year was the ability to condense.
Okay.
And I think that that's going to be a very practical way of going about doing this.
So there'll be the same list of information, same list of attestations, but one yes at the end? Is that what you're saying?
Right. You're going to have to cover all of the points that you want to cover in an attestation, mm-hmm. but you're going to want to do it in a way in what frankly makes it user-friendly.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you have said that your proposal does not contemplate forwarding any contributor information to the political committees such that they could potentially report. Is it possible to do that?
Now, the data aggregators are not going to be in a possession of the sort of name and address information that a political committee would be able to get from their own interactions with their donors. So if you're looking for a political committee wanting to have information about its donors, it's most likely, Commissioner, that that collection will occur as the political committee creates its own relationship with those donors over time.
Right, but it won't. How will it know who the donors are?
They will have the phone numbers.
They'll have the phone numbers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So when they get the contributions, they'll be associated with a phone number, but there won't be a name and address?
Every time that an individual like interact with any entity, whether it be the Red Cross or American Idol or, you know, Craig for President, God forbid, that
I've seen less credible candidates.
Thank you. You'll see that they will always have that data trail of what phone number is originated, you know, that text, that, you know, that vote or that charitable contribution. And that's a key thing, that that trail include that phone number, because the recipient political committee or corporation or charity is always going to want to make sure that they can maintain a relationship with the people who just supported them.
So they could call the number back or text the number back and collect whatever information. You know, if we said you need to report this in some scenarios, there's a potential that they could do that?
The potential is going to be regulated by a couple of other federal agencies and the ability of an organization to return back a text to someone who texts them, because there are rules as to how much you can generate texts back to someone who has texted you.
I'm so relieved to hear that. But what's the consequence in this setting for?
Well, the consequence is that there will always be a record of the telephone number that originated the pledge.
So let's say somebody gets, a political committee gets a pledge from, I think under your plan, they could get $50 a month?
They could get $50 a month, right.
Let's take a single phone user with a single, you know, one account with one phone. Take the simple scenario first, okay? So under that plan, somebody might text $50 one month and say, wow, that was fun. I like doing that. And I think I continue to like this candidate. So the next month they do it again, and then they do it again. You know, at some point they're going to, in fact, in 4 months, they're going to reach $200. So at that point, the political committee will be in receipt of $200 from a phone number. Will they have a mechanism of, you know, putting aside, you know, I understand the, you know, there's an argument under the pass the hat rule that maybe they wouldn't have to do that, but let's put that one aside for the moment. If they wanted to report that, would they have a means of gathering the information? Or would these other rules that you're talking about prohibit them from retexting or calling that person in order to try and extract that information?
I think there are a couple things at play here. I think the first one is that a political committee is going to want to find out itself as much as it can about people who are giving money to it, with the hope that they will not get another $10 texted donation, but a $100 check.
Right.
And they will always want to have
$2,500 check, right?
They will always want to have as much data about their donors as the technology allows. And in this particular case, what the technology will allow is the political committee to have the phone number of the person who's just texted them a $10 donation. And it's most likely that political committee will say, please go visit meforpresident.com. And then when that person goes and then logs on to that website of that presidential campaign, then there'll be a tremendous amount of ways for that committee to mine the data.
So they can go back and say they can retext them, because I'm not up on the FCC rules or
right.
whatever entity regulates what kind of texting you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make sure that I'm understanding you correctly. So I think what you're saying is they can send them back some message by text asking them to visit the website, but they can't actually ask them directly for the information. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure I'm saying that so much as that I know that there are a tremendous amount of technological abilities that are also permissible under communications laws for the recipient of texted information, whether it be, you know, a donation or some kind of pledge or just, you know, a vote for a particular program, that recipient of that information will be able to continue a relationship with the person who has texted it because they will have their phone number.
Right. I think under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, either in the form of a text or a telephone call, they can respond and say, can we contact you again? And the recipient can say yes or no if they don't want to be contacted again. So someone who wanted to truly remain anonymous could say no.
But presumably somebody who is motivated to give repeatedly to the same candidate might not object to that.
And the campaign would have an incentive to be able to maintain that communication link with those donors, right?
Okay. All right. Now let's complicate the scenario. Help me out with the multiple phones on the same account, because this is what I know from my family and from my friends, that, you know, I'm of a generation where a lot of my friends have teenagers, and as do I, and we all have family plans on our phones, and everybody's, you know, got, you know, 4, 5 maybe phones on one account. The parent pays the bill. Kids don't really contribute to the phone bill. I mean, they could, but the reality is, in the families that I know, they don't. And in most of the families I know, the families are, you know, it's not like that family on the old sitcom with Michael J. Fox playing Alex Keaton, where the son was conservative and the parents were liberal. Most of the families I know, they all are of the same political persuasion. So it doesn't strike me as completely unlikely that multiple people in the same nuclear family might want to contribute to the same candidate. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. What protections are there that against... And I don't think anybody would do that, believe me, I don't think anybody would do this as some nefarious plot to defeat the contribution limits, because in this day and age, if you had money and you wanted to give a lot of it in support of a candidate, there are so many easier ways to do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not anticipating that, you know, people are going to say, oh, this is a great way that I can beat the contribution limits by having my kid give this amount and then I'll give that amount. But I do think it could happen inadvertently. So what protections are there that against, you know, the parent writing, you know, paying the bill every month on the phone bill, and because there are 4 or 5 people on the account and everybody's supporting the same candidate, you end up busting the contribution limits, you end up going through doing more than $50 a month, doing more than, ending up with more than $200 and, mm-hmm. you know, triggering disclosure requirements.
Commissioner, I think the answer to that is the attestation. That before someone can make a donation, before they can opt in, they have to say that the money's going to be theirs. and you cannot make a contribution unless you say the money is going to be yours. These attestation requirements, you know, are not law. They were created by the commission to create, you know, a safe harbor. And, you know, you're either in the safe harbor or you're not. And having created a safe harbor for political committees and corporations to put themselves into, to say, before you give to me, you must tell me that it is you who are giving to me. And the commission said, yes, if you do that, you've got a really strong presumption that the money that you are going to be collecting will be lawful. That is why we have, you know, safe harbors and attestations, and that's the answer here. Is it possible that a family could get together, either knowingly or unknowingly, conspiratorial or not, and do something that could create one person making a contribution in the name of another? Yes, that's always possible. But I read draft B, and I read the last sentence in footnote 10 in draft B, and that pretty much said it all to me, which is, if you can't believe it here, you can't believe it anywhere. And in fact, in this particular case,
Frank Sinatra.
And in this particular case, given the amount of, you know, work that goes into making a texted contribution, I think you can believe it here.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that that the commission has relied on those attestations in the circumstance of individuals in the same family making contributions on a jointly held credit card. The assumption is that each person affirmed that it's going to come from their own money, and that when the credit card bill arrives, like in my house, when it arrives and I say, honey, you got an awful lot of iTunes charges here, you're going to have to give me some money so I can pay the bill. The assumption is that there will be an intra-family transaction so that the person who pays the bill receives the money from the person who actually made the contribution.
I won't ask you, you know, I mean, one of the reasons most of the families I know, the teenagers don't contribute to the phone bill is because the only place they would have to go to get the money is going back to the parents anyway. So, you know, it's kind of a circular transaction.
Right.
I think my colleague wanted to ask a follow-up, and I'm willing to yield if that's okay with
you. Sure. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. I was on this family plan topic. I think I share my colleague's view that this is, and frankly what you said in your request, that, you know, we're trying to fit the digital mobile wireless industry into regs and a statute that was written at the time of, you know, the rotary phones, and one that actually hurts your finger when you were trying
That's
to
right.
move them around the dial. But I hear your point about credit cards, but I also think they're a little bit different factually in that there aren't major ad campaigns out there promoting family plans for credit cards or in giving discounts when you have a number of people on the same account. So it's just a little bit different. And I also note that, you know, when I need help with my phone or my iPad, I find the nearest 8-year-old. I mean, it's true that, you know, the reality is, unlike a credit card, there are 8-year-olds walking around with cell phones and 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds and a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be engaging in, boy, we'd be in a real financial crisis when we let 13-year-olds have credit cards all over the place. But I think that is one of the challenges here, is that they are phones and the way that you would make these contributions are ubiquitous. And unfortunately, we've become part of this culture where you click through all of the terms of service and all of that very quickly without reading them. And I think you know have read these news stories about people getting a bill from some game company where their kid has purchased $3,000 worth of fish. Apparently, I don't play this game. I don't have it, but I've read this. And so, now I assume what you would tell me is that in those instances, it would be up to the person who pays the bill to basically say, I'm not following through on this pledge, right?
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
and so in that instance, what happens on your side? You've got an agreement between MCUBE and the political committee. You've advanced some of these funds. And so basically the committee would just give back the money. I'm trying to understand what this pledge means. It's like, is it like on the, you know, the telethons for NPR where I can make a pledge, but it's, you know, I can call and say I'm giving $1,000 and NPR's not coming after me.
Right.
You know, so I'm trying to understand the nature of these pledges, and particularly in, given this is, I think, a real problem in terms of phones are different than credit cards in that way, in that they are marketed, they are cheaper if you have a family plan than if you have individual, and those are just very different facts than the credit card scenario.
Commissioner, I think you're tying together two things that absolutely need to be tied together. The first one is the advent of cellular technology, texting, and family plans. And secondly, the key part of factoring, which puts us in a position of wanting to withhold money to make sure that the amount of money that's been texted is actually paid. When you talk about, you know, the family plans and wanting to make sure that people pay their share of a phone bill, or someone objects and later says, I didn't authorize that, I'm not paying that, that may very well happen quite frequently, you know, with family plans, with games with fish, or with political contributions. That's why the factoring part is so important for an aggregator to make sure that they do not advance 100% of the contributions that they may be receiving right at the beginning. There has to be that holdback in order for the contribution amounts to settle out, to make sure what has been pledged is collected. So in order to make sure that, you know, with a family plan or even an individual phone number, that the amount of money that is pledged is what is actually collected, in order to protect against a situation where there are a lot of uncollected pledges, that's why the factoring has that holdback percentage.
What if the amount of pledges that come in is in excess of the holdback? So the trade, you know,
the amount of pledges that come in,
yes,
are in excess of the holdback.
Are less than. You've given them more than what actually comes in the door. You've given the political committee, so let's say there are pledges of $1,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, you
advance, let's say, if it's, right, a 60% scenario, and then what comes in is $10 because, you know, maybe some candidate makes some huge gaffe and suddenly people are like, whoa.
I think the great thing about, you know, working with data aggregators and holdbacks is that these holdback percentages can be dialed up and dialed down on the sensitivity of the pledges and how many are being fulfilled or not being fulfilled on a daily basis. This is a very highly sophisticated, computerized analysis that's going on about the amount of money that's being pledged and the amount of money that's being collected. So the goal, of course, of a data aggregator is to not over advance, whether it's to American Idol, the Red Cross, or, you know, Craig for President. So I think that the important thing is that their computer sensitivities are such is that if they see pledge fulfillment starting to fall below their minimum expectation, then the dial down becomes even more so that they do not get into a situation where they have over advanced.
I understand that's their business incentive. I'm saying, what happens if they do? What happens if on day one,
right,
people make $10,000 worth of pledges to this candidate? On day two, the candidate drops out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
And then nobody's, you know, people are, when they get their bill, they don't feel the need to fulfill a pledge for someone who's no longer in their race. What happens then?
There is another, at least one other safeguard that would help in this system. The aggregator can require the political committee to make a deposit. To give money to the data aggregator up front to protect against a high rate of individuals reneging on their pledges. So there are actually several safeguards in place to prevent against a high renege rate. And the aggregator has a commercial incentive to build in as many safeguards as possible to protect against a high renege rate or a change in the renege rate. And that's why they analyze this on a weekly or sometimes daily basis to adjust the factor, ask for an additional deposit from the political committee. They're very sensitive and they've been doing this for a long time in structuring the commercial relationships with charities and for-profit corporations to protect themselves, because the data aggregators This is a business for them. They have no interest whatsoever in making any contributions. They want to protect against making contributions. They're just trying to make a business. So they protect themselves from exactly the circumstance to the extent that it's doable, and they can adjust it periodically to prevent against those conditions.
We're getting a little broader than I'd asked, so I'm going to yield back to my colleague. But I would just note that I think this is an area that is a little bit of concern to me, because I completely understand their interest. This is a business for them. But I also think that politics can be somewhat more surprising than the result on American Idol. So there might be factors in the political process that really change motives of people who are making pledges. And again, this is a question that my colleague asked earlier. We're now thinking about advancing the idea of contribution to the date of the pledge. And so that's factoring in here, too. Thank you.
I'm almost done. The other issue I wanted to raise was in the CTIA opinion that the commission issued a couple of years ago, the commission said that yes, you can have certifications, but where the certification is contradicted by evidence contained in the monthly bill, the wireless service providers would not be able to rely on the certification and would be required to forward to the recipient committee the information that's required under the Act. I think I know what your answer to this question is going to be, but, you know, if the phone bill goes to a business address, you know, not to an individual, but it's mm-hmm. addressed to, you know, CFO of the XYZ Corporation, to use a lot of initials, what protection is there to ensure that it isn't a corporate contribution, that it isn't a corporation that owns the mm-hmm. phones, basically?
When I read that in the CTIA advisory opinion, I had a little difficulty understanding or appreciating that, because what a political committee has to do, or someone, a corporation assisting a political committee has to do, is examine contributions for evidence of illegalities. Now, a phone bill is not a contribution. It's a bill. It's basically something on the outside of an envelope where a bill is sent. The contribution is, of course, the way in which that payment is made to pay the bill. In my personal life, you know, most of my bills come to my law firm. And just because it says my law firm's name on the bill doesn't mean at all that the person paying the bill is the law firm. It just happens to be where an individual gets his or her mail. So I think it's a very, very important point, is that a phone bill, the address on a phone bill, is not a contribution.
But what if the address just has no name on it at all? It just says Chief Financial Officer, XYZ Corporation. Not even addressed to an individual. Just seems to be going to a corporate entity.
That a phone bill would not have a person's name on it, but just have someone's title, would have a title on it and a corporation's address on it.
Because the corporation actually is the customer. So they don't care who in the corporation pays the bill. They just need to get it to the customer.
I'm having trouble, like, getting my hands around that hypothetical, other than to say that I go back to, I think, the thing that's very key about all of this, whether it be in credit card contributions or how you fill out a donor card when you're writing a check or when you're texting. You know, you have to attest to the fact that the money that you're going to be contributing, your contribution, is lawful.
Yeah, I figured that's where you were going to end up, was it goes back to the attestations. I'm trying to think if I have any other questions. I think I'm done, at least for now, but I really appreciate your patiently walking me through all the scenarios.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Commission has for many years allowed contributions to be made by means of credit cards, and what I hear you saying is that if we said no to your request, it would call into question the basis for the Commission's past determinations about permitting contributions through credit cards. And would it be safe to say that we were talking about factoring, that there already is a factoring relationship? It may be called something differently in the credit card scenario, but there really is a factoring relationship there in the mm-hmm. sense that when someone swipes their card or inputs it into a website to make a contribution to a political committee, there's a factoring relationship in the sense that the credit card company then is going to send 100% of that amount to the political committee, and then at the back end, they will receive receive a payment from the person who swiped the credit card. If they don't, then the credit card company mm-hmm. will go after the contributor. So really, we've kind of gone, from what I hear you saying, we've already kind of gone down this road. And if anything, it sounds like the mechanism that you're proposing has greater built-in safeguards to prevent against the possibility of a corporate contribution. Am I understanding that correctly? I mean, in the sense that you're actually holding back a portion to ensure that no corporate money is being...
That's exactly what we're trying to do, sir. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because in the case of a credit card contribution, let's say that a contributor makes a $1,000 contribution by means of credit card, that $1,000 goes to the political committee, and then if that... individual let's say that they inputted it on a website, then doesn't pay, and let's say that gets dragged out for long-standing dispute between credit card company and that individual, that $1,000 is still in the coffers of the political committee. But and that's the scenario, worst case scenario, but we've kind of built that into the baked that into the cake, and we've decided to go down that road, and so there's nothing that you're proposing that isn't already something that the Commission hasn't approved for a very long time.
Correct.
Okay. And also on the terms of the terminology, we're talking about pledge. I wonder if there's a little bit. Every Christmas time, I'll get a call from the local volunteer fire department saying, "Will you pledge to make a contribution to help our brave men and women who serve to protect our community?" And there's the pledge in the sense in that case where I can make a pledge. They'll send me an envelope, hoping that I'll send a check. They don't really have it. There's no teeth to that. I mean, if I send it, that's great. If I don't, they don't have any means to come after me. It's a little bit different in this scenario. Am I right?
Well, that's correct. Because
so maybe pledge is, we're using the term pledge, but we're not using it maybe in the term, the more colloquial sense that we often mm-hmm. think of the word pledge.
I would agree with that. I think that you're right. There is no enforceable contract between you and someone who's calling you up at Christmas time that you're trying to get off the phone by saying, "Yes, I'll give, send me an envelope." That may be a pledge. But in this particular situation, much like with a credit card contribution, you've signed a contract. You've engaged in some sort of commercial transaction with your carrier or with your bank to say, "I am going to be making obligations either through texting by opting in or by charging." And there is some sort of tremendous presumption that you're going to be following through on that contractual obligation that you have agreed to in order to get that credit card or in order to get that phone. So it's very, very much more contractually sophisticated than the colloquial use of the term pledge that we were talking about.
And finally, just in terms of how Congress developed the law to deal with anonymous contributions, while it's true, the law, the technologies have evolved in the 30 plus years since the law was first enacted. The legal categories could still account for this sort of a situation. And I know there was a comment that was submitted by former Commissioner David Mason, basically saying that there's a scheme in place for dealing with anonymous contributions, even though the technologies have evolved, and even though we can consider and we can conjure up in our minds worst-case scenarios where these could be undermined,
mm-hmm.
or where we think that there might be loopholes. Ultimately, that's Congress's decision. They've made the policy, and if they want to change that policy in light of further technological developments, that's their prerogative. But that's not necessarily the commission's prerogative.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I haven't had a chance to read the comments that came in last night, so they may answer some of the questions I might have. What information does the political committee get every month?
The political committee will be getting a breakdown of all of the phone numbers, as I understand it, that have initiated these pledges to them, and the gross receipts that the program will be generating for them.
Well, they get the amount of money that each telephone number has actually, whose money has actually been good for it. In other words, will they get any information about non-pay of the pledge from that telephone number?
I don't know the answer to that as to whether or not the data will be so sophisticated that it will go back and see who did or did not make complete payment of a pledge.
So a political committee might get a list of telephone numbers and an aggregate amount at the bottom, and that would be all they could have. If they wanted to drill down a little bit to find out any information, that would be their only access would be to call that number, or what?
I'm not sure that that's the only option that they have, but I can certainly find out whether or not there can be that second round of data that you're talking about.
Well, I think one of the things that bothers me is, what if a corporation, an aggregator, and we've had some massive instances now where there's been misuse of the system, I'm sure you read about it, but if you have a corporation that wants to make corporate contributions, just use their money and make it good, what would we be able to know about how to prevent that, a political committee? If the aggregator or a corporation and just wanted to make good on all bad debts and get as much money as possible, the political committee, regardless of whether the aggregator paid for it or were in good faith, what would the political committee be able to do to discover that?
In this particular situation, as I've been working with this advisory opinion request, I've not come across a situation where the aggregator that we're working with, or the aggregators in the industry, have any desire to put forward one more dollar than they believe will be collected. So it's not really come forward in any sort of hypothetical that we've been working on that a aggregator is going to want to advance or factor to any political committee, charity, or corporation a dollar more than they ever believe will be collected.
Well, I think that's probably true so far, but there can be exceptions, and I wondered how a political committee would be able to, if they sense something, be able to find out enough information to see that. In other words, there may be people out there, corporations, who want to use whatever method works to buttress the campaign. And so I don't think we should necessarily assume that in all instances, all good faith will always exist, and you don't therefore need some kind of sufficient information to work through the problem if there is one.
Well, Commissioner, the one additional protection or safeguard or maybe comfort that you can have in a situation like this is that the data aggregating and wireless and carrier industry is highly regulated from a lot of different compass points. There are a lot of federal agencies who have a stake or a share in making sure that any information, whether it's data or money, is regulated and protected for privacy reasons, trade reasons, and communications reasons. Also, one of the things that I've become impressed with in this particular industry are the very high standards in which this industry has chosen to regulate itself. And when you look at CTIA and the association that this industry belongs to, you can see that they hold themselves voluntarily to standards to make sure the sort of situations that you're hypothesizing about don't happen.
Further on the question of multi-party situations.
Right.
And how, whether teenagers or otherwise, or just multi-party situations, who are using the same telephone number, the committee would only know, as I understand it, one number. Or they would know several numbers, and they would be paid for by one, I guess, contractor with the mm-hmm. telephone company, for example. So how can, in other words, it seemed to me your comment was, well, if there was an overpayment, we would assume that automatically that it got worked out internally within the so-called family or the so-called co-users. I think you were using the word users.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded to me like it's like you could write one big check for $10,000 and assume that the four people in the family are going to work that one out. And I'm just trying to think why we don't have to take a look at it in somewhat the same way as we would an overpayment of one check. Or we don't necessarily take one check and assume that everybody's going to it's going to be used equally within the family out of their own funds. So sometimes you have to give the money back and have them agree, especially a check if it's written to two people.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a situation where you can get the money all from one payor, but we can't be sure that it's going to be allocated among the various users.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on trust.
I beg your pardon?
That's basically on trust.
I think that's on the basis of several things. First of all, that, you know, what the political committees are going to be doing in this situation are soliciting, in this particular hypothetical, a $10 contribution. That's all they're asking for, is a $10 contribution in this hypothetical from any one person. And they're not asking for, you know, a $50 contribution or a $100 contribution. The transaction that they are looking for is just one for a $10 contribution. If four or five or six $10 contributions on the same plan aggregate to greater than $50, you have two things to rely upon. First of all, the fact that the wireless user has said, I am going to make this contribution of $10 with my own money. And the second thing is that because all of these individual wireless user accounts are merged into one bill, the person who pays that bill, if in fact there is only one person paying the bill, we can also certainly think that more than one person
is. That's the way it is.
I beg your pardon?
See, in our family, that's the way it is, I'll tell you that.
And
so I'm just trying to see how that information gets sifted out to anybody for evaluation. If it appeared to be a problem, could the political committee have a way to drill back down?
Well, I think the political committee has a very, very good piece of information, and that's the attestation. And the person who is going to pay the phone bill, if there's this one person paying the phone bill, he or she also has a very good piece of information in front of him or her, an itemized listing of what they're going to be paying. And in your hypothetical, if the father is looking at a phone bill and sees contributions to political committees that he or she doesn't disagree with, then he may want to go about collecting that money from the person who pledged it.
Well, I also think it's
father finding out it was a political committee.
I also think it's important to point out that the committee is going to receive the individual phone number from which the pledge was made. So even if there's one plan with five people on it, they're going to get and four of them made contributions, they're going to get four separate numbers.
Right, they'll have no way of knowing it came from one payor.
They don't know who paid the bill.
Right.
They know that one person made the pledge, but I shouldn't be a contractual obligation rather than pledge. But they will know that four separate transactions occurred. And
the political committee would know that, but they'd have no way of knowing
they don't know when it's paid. Well, and again, it goes back to the point that it's not they're not getting a contribution; it's they're buying and selling an asset.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Madam Vice Chair?
Thought of a few more. The $10, is that a hypothetical or is that the business model that only $10 would be asked for?
That's what we're putting forward right now. It's quite possible that we could have $5 limits or maybe $20 limits, but what we're working with right now for this situation, and in answering some of the hypotheticals that I've been working with your general counsel's office, we're assuming like a $10 donation.
But if we say Godspeed, go ahead, there wouldn't be a limit on the there wouldn't be a limit that political committees relying on this AO could only ask for $10 by way of text message, or would there?
Well, I think the important thing is making sure that the data aggregator is putting a cap on the amount of money any one user can contribute in any month.
And that would be $50 per month.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, the certifications from the CTIA request that you said you were going to adopt as well include one that says, I certify that my total contributions by text message to this recipient will not exceed $50 this calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
Are you keeping that one?
No, the certifications that we're going to be working with here are making sure that an individual's subscriber does not make more than $50 in any one payment cycle.
But are you not asking for that attestation? Because I thought you had said earlier that you were going to. I mean, I'm looking at the CTIA request, and there mm-hmm. are six messages that it says
right.
would
mm-hmm.
be conveyed. Thank you for your interest in contributing. Reply yes to proceed with the required legal certifications. Reply no if you don't wish to proceed. Two, I certify that I will make this contribution by paying my wireless bill with my personal unreimbursed funds. Reply Y or N to proceed. Three, I certify that this contribution will not be made by a corporation, labor organization, or other person paying my wireless bill.
Right.
Reply Y or N to proceed. Four, I certify that I am not a foreign national or government contractor. Five, I certify that my total contributions by text message to this recipient will not exceed $50 this calendar year. And six, contributions to political committees are not tax deductible.
Right.
And, you know, I heard you say, well, you're not going to have the yes, no after each one of those, but
right.
are you going to have all of those messages? And if not, which of those are you going to have?
Well, we wouldn't have the calendar year one because that's
okay,
not our request.
Okay.
That was theirs. But what I think the important thing is to have the attestations that say that this particular contribution is my contribution and I'm a lawful donor.
Is that it?
Oh, and spelled out in the way in which you were talking about. You know, I'm a lawful donor. I'm not a corporation. I'm not being reimbursed by
not
this.
Not a foreign national.
Not a foreign national.
Not a government contractor.
So you're going to have all of those things listed out there, but there's not going to be because I had heard you to say earlier that you were going to incorporate all of these. So if you're not going to incorporate the $50 cap in the calendar year, are there any others in there that I just read that you're not going to include?
No, they're going to be included. I'm just going to make sure that their factual proposal in CTIA was different than our factual proposal. But in terms of wanting to make sure that there's an attestation that the donation is lawful in amount and source and not being reimbursed and that the donor is lawful, yes, yes. That's all the sorts of attestations that we're going to want because we're going to rely upon them.
I think in our proposal, we said that we would use the same attestations that the commission approved in its advisory opinion to the DSCC last year, which are the disclaimers which all campaign committees have to have on their websites.
All right.
We did not incorporate the attestations that the CTIA referred to in their advisory opinion.
Oh, okay. So I was a little confused about that. Could I ask you, because as I said, we're not going to vote on this today. I'm not ready to vote on this today. Could I ask you to supply to us the specific list of attestations that you are going to require? Because that would be important to me to know exactly what you're going to ask. If we're going to rely on these attestations, I need to know what they are.
Okay.
So if you could do that, that would be very helpful to me. And, you know, on this $50 issue, Without reading too much into the question, but suppose it turned out that commissioners weren't comfortable with the $50 per phone limit per month. If the commission were to say the only way we can get four votes is to cap it at $50 per account, $50 per bill payer, you know, so that, you know, and the example of, you know, in my family plan, I get the bill, there's four phones on the account, but there would be a $50 limit on combined on all four of those phones. Could you implement that if we were to say that's the only way you could get your, yes, would
no.
that be possible? That's not possible.
No, I don't think that that's, frankly, fair.
No, that's not what I'm asking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking whether it's possible.
I don't know if it's possible or not. It's never really occurred to us that that would be a way to approach this.
Well, suppose some commissioners felt that, and I'm not saying this is where I'm going to land. I'm just kind of playing out hypotheticals.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose it turned out that commissioners came to the conclusion that they just didn't feel comfortable with knowing the way these plans are marketed to families, knowing the way most families pay their bills, which is to have one person, usually one of the parents, you know, although actually I have my mother on my phone plan also, so, you know, in that case I'm the child, but one person is paying the bill for all of these phones on one, you know, either electronic transaction or check if you're more old-fashioned, and it's all coming out of one bank account, which may be a joint bank account between spouses, who knows. But suppose we didn't have confidence that the kids were going to be ponying up their share of the bill. I mean, I can only say that, you know, when my daughter texted Haiti, she didn't give me the $10. And I didn't ask her for the $10, but, you know, I paid it. She made the text. I paid the bill. And I think that could happen. I think that's a foreseeable possibility. Now, I understand what you're saying, that the attestations guard against that, and that may be the conclusion of the commission. But if that's not the conclusion of the commission, that suffices, could there be a $50 cap placed per account as opposed to per phone?
I think that would have to be a commercial decision by the aggregators, whether they could offer the service if that restriction was in place. I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
I ran out of questions again.
I'm going to let Commissioner McGann go, Steve, because you, Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I don't really have any questions for the requester. I thought that the concern in the previous AO that dealt with the same sort of issue was the 10-day rule, and I think the requester has found a way, at least from my point of view, to address that, and frankly, I think knocked it out of the park. So that's, for me, was the tough issue. I want to echo, it was really in form of a question, but I'll assume it was also the statement on what really is a pledge that the Commissioner Peterson brought up. You know, in the traditional sense, in campaign speak, a pledge is when someone says, oh yeah, I'll get you the check, Congressman, sure. You don't book that. That doesn't show up on the report. So when you use the word pledge, that sounds like there's no teeth, but it's really not a pledge in the traditional sense of pledge. It's mm-hmm. a pledge plus. It's a pledge with teeth. There's some sort of obligation there, which to me makes it feel a lot more like a credit card. Even a check, once you sign a check, if you're unencumbered by what a check really is, that's just a pledge, right? I mean, that mm-hmm. you know, of course, you should have money in the bank account, and you can go to jail if you don't and all that, but if you don't really know the details, seems like the same kind of thing. So to the extent that you're using the word pledge, I guess it is a question. It's really the same question. You've already answered it, but it's not really a pledge in the traditional sense. There are some teeth here, or teeth, right? That, I think, gives some of us comfort. I thought the comments were very helpful, particularly the ones from Aristotle that Commissioner Peterson mentioned, filed by Dave Mason, because he refocuses the issue back on the statute. And when you come at it from that point of view, you realize that Congress has said small money is not a big deal. Now, whether they said that because you can't track money at a pass the hat or because it's not corrupting or gives the appearance of corruption, it's not really for us to say. I think it's probably both. But it's not simply because it can't be tracked. It's simply because you maybe theoretically could track this to some degree that's not the same as a pass the hat. I don't think it's up to the commission to then impose that. Now, you've gone, even though even though that's the case, you still have the attestation, and you still are putting the protection on, in my view, to a sufficient degree, which does give comfort to preventing some massive anti-circumvention or, you know, foreign national money coming in or all the sort of boogeymen that get thrown around whenever we talk about small electronic money. But to me, this seems to be a high-tech pass the hat. In fact, the Obama committee seems to say the same thing, as does the Romney committee. So what's nice about your request is it's brought together Obama and Romney on a point. It's maybe the last time this year that they agree, but at least we're here to witness the magic. But look, Congress has essentially said you can pass the hat, and all the concerns that come up here are valid concerns, and different commissioners, I think, need different comfort levels to get sufficient votes to give you an affirmative yes. And when you're in the world of trying to make a profit providing a service, you'd much rather have a yes on paper with the protection of an AO than we'll take our chances in a MER. So, I mean, I'm on draft B, and I do invite you, if there's something in draft B that isn't quite right, please file a comment. I'm not going to put you on the spot now to critique it, but if there's any sort of details in there that aren't quite right, open to change it. But to me, you know, you could have a pass the hat, and I'll keep it in small numbers because we're lawyers, so we'll keep it in tens. You could have 10 people at a pass the hat, and no one really watches who puts money in the hat, when you know there's $100 at the end of the event, and you think everybody put in $10, but really somebody could have put in $10 bills and nobody else could have put in anything, or somebody could have put in money for the kids. That's common. That's happened forever in America, and you know, democracy hasn't crumbled and people haven't been corrupted because of that. What's different is the high tech. You could have, it's not like a person going in a room passing the hats. People you don't see do this, but you've put the belt and suspenders on this. But back to the pass the hat, I mean, to address the concern of, is it possible that somebody could find a way to manipulate this? And sure, that's the case in all money transactions. Pass the hats. Are you going to write down the serial numbers of the bills? I mean, somebody could flood up, you know, so just pass the hat circuit and start throwing cash in the plate. But if no one knows who really gave the money, where's the appearance of corruption? That's what I never understood. You know, I guess somebody could whisper, hey, you know, all that cash was really mine. Oh, okay. You kind of roll the eye, like, sure it was. No, you can't prove it either way. Mm-hmm. I think you've done what you need to do to avoid a large-scale problem. But some of the detail that I've heard suggested, I think Craig Engel pointed out, is not really in the law. It's stuff the commission's developed in AOs to avoid the big problem. I think you've done that. You know, I think it's a great system, and I hope we can get to a yes. And my sense is we may be able to. I don't want to speak for everybody, but I appreciate the questions everyone's asked. It's been very helpful. So I just want to state where I am. So to the extent you file additional comments, you know what bait to put on the hook. I'm already in the boat. So.
Okay. Commissioner Walther.
Well, I don't have any clever analogies like that. That was pretty good. But if you just say you have a first-time contribution and they don't pay, you got a credit card, not a debit card. I'd like to get your thoughts on the debit versus credit, if it makes a difference in your business model. But then you have to pay the political committee under the scenarios. I understand it. Credit's been given. They get the money. And if the no pay comes in, do you ask them for the money back? Or is part of the risk of doing business the non-pay? Now, I understand that if maybe you have 20 payments and you've built, and we'll talk about that in a second too, when is the payment your money?
In terms of the no pay and asking for the money back, are you referring to the relationship between the carrier and their customer, the aggregator and the carrier? Or the aggregator and the tester.
The way I understand it, you advance the money to the political committee based upon taking a risk that it's going to get paid, and for that risk you get some compensation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like a little insurance company. And but in a case where you never don't get paid, you know, the insurance doesn't work, and so the political committee gets your money because you paid it in advance in 4 days, and then 30 days comes along and no one gets paid. What happens then in terms of the political committee?
Well, in this particular case, in the texting and aggregation, the scenario is that there will be more than just one contribution coming in on any one particular day, and that a factor being withheld of all of that money will let all of the donations come in a percentage that will make good on that factored amount.
Well, I guess that's right, but you're using someone else's money to deal with that one account.
Yeah, I would point out that one of the other safeguards.
Go ahead.
And if your assumption, that is an assumption, but let's just talk about a one-time situation at some point. Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the other safeguards is that the political committee may have had to already give money to the aggregator on deposit to account for renege. So if the committee gives the aggregator a lump sum and people don't pay, then the aggregator is made whole because they've already received money from the political committee in the form of a deposit, and they can account for those renegs by money that they already got from. So instead of the committee paying the money back after the end, they've actually paid. They've prepaid contributions that have to be returned.
Right, but the political committee, the whole idea of advancing the money to the political committee is they need the money.
Right.
So if you're asking them to pay you in advance, it doesn't work very well for the political committee.
Well, that's one of the safeguards. There are several.
It's a safeguard, but are you going to use that one? Because why would that be attractive to a political committee at that point?
Well, I think
pay me
in order
money
to
in advance, and we'll give you a money discount amount,
right?
Because we're taking a risk that they are going to pay, and if they don't, we have your money already.
Right. Well, the aggregator and the campaign are entering into a contractual relationship based on their individual needs and requirements, and the aggregator might require a deposit if they think there's going to be a particularly high level of renegs. So each one of these relationships is going to be a separate contractual relationship, and the different safeguards will be adjusted to account for the aggregator's belief on their ability to collect. And they have, you know, years of experience in assessing this in terms of reneg rates on charitable contributions and payments to corporations.
Let me go back, though, to the scenario when you have a non-pay and the political committee, what they end up getting is corporate money. Am I correct about that? Because the only money that you have is even if you aggregate it, I'd like an isolated situation conversation, but even if you aggregate it with other people on that given day, they still end up with corporate money, don't they?
The situation would end in this following way. Let's say that there is just one contribution throughout the entire system, maybe one $10 contribution. The aggregator forwards $7 through factoring, and that one contribution does not get collected. Well, under the terms of the service order, the political committee owes a debt to the aggregator. They have to give the money back. I mean, just because it's a factored contribution doesn't mean that there isn't a reconciliation one way or another. With your hypothetical about there only being one texted donation in this program, if $10 comes in, $7 is factored, and it is collected, and all $10 comes in, well, the political committee is entitled to the rest of that $10 minus fees. If the $10 doesn't come in at all, the aggregator is entitled to their money back.
Okay, so they have received corporate money, and the idea is that the political committee has to pay back the corporation the money that's advanced.
Right. I mean, it would be, and it's not a corporate contribution or anything like that. It is either a sale of an asset or an extension of credit within someone's ordinary course of business. I mean, the goal here is to make sure that the corporation makes its money and the political committee receives its contributions.
Right, but let me just, I'm not trying to make it hard to not
I'm following you.
Get to yes, but let me just tell you why. To me, the way it works out is if you don't get a pay, the political committee gets corporate money. And if they then don't pay and you want the money back, the political committee has been giving the political, excuse me, the aggregator has been giving the political committee a loan, and they have to pay it back. So I'm just wondering, Is that the way it's structured? The agreement provides exactly that way?
Well, in the service order, if there was ever a situation where the program was not generating the pledges or collections that have been factored, then the program will stop until the aggregator's books are back in balance. Because the aggregator is never want to be in a position, Commissioner, to over-factor any money at all.
I recognize that. That's all insurance companies figure that way, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Right.
But I wanted to just cover the situation, of course, where it does not work.
Right.
And that, then when do you consider the money yours? When you take the factoring, is that yours for accounting purposes?
Yours meaning whose?
Say the $3. The three of the seven? The $3 of the 10.
By yours, you mean the aggregators?
Well, your model was that of $10, 7 goes to the political committee, 3 is retained.
Mm-hmm.
When does that become your money?
Your money meaning whose money?
Aggregators' money.
The aggregators' money.
When do you consider yourself paid?
Well, I would imagine that because this is going to be happening nearly, you know, daily, if not maybe once a week or every 10 days, that there's going to be this constant reconciliation that is going to be occurring, and that money is going to be factored and then reconciled on an ongoing basis. And what we wouldn't look at this is necessarily on, you know, $10 by $10 donations, but instead by the groups of donations that are coming in over any 7 or 10 day period.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
It's such an interesting topic. I keep thinking of more questions. Something actually that Commissioner Gann mentioned kind of triggered this, because he mentioned the possibility of foreign contributions. Would foreign-owned cell phone companies be eligible to participate in this?
You know, I work with the aggregator on this particular question and on the ability of foreign-sourced plans.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd like to do is talk to the aggregator and maybe give you a written answer to make sure that that particular question is really put out on paper.
Okay, that would be fine, because I think it would. I mean, that would again give some comfort to folks. I think if there was some restriction such that what's the big Mexican cell phone company? I can't remember the name of it. I thought you're making a suggestion. I'm blanking on the name, but you know there are, you know, if there was some limit such that a Mexican or Canadian or whatever cell phone company couldn't participate in this program, then I think that would help to alleviate concerns that foreign money would be might use this vehicle to leak into the system. You know, as opposed to if they could participate, then it seems like it kind of opens the door to that possibility in a way that maybe people weren't thinking about. So I think that would be a helpful restriction if it could be incorporated.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. And we've only been on this for like an hour, so there seems to be some anxiousness over there, but this is actually not an average AO discussion.
We're having fun.
Okay, good. And I just have one. I appreciate the analogy to the path of the hat, and I absolutely understand that. But again, we're kind of in a rotary dial world versus digital world,
right?
Because you've told us that they will get a list of the phone numbers, so it's not entirely anonymous. I don't think anyone would ever suggest you have to track serial numbers or dollar bills, and I'm not really sure what that would get you anyway, because they're not attributable to any one person. So I think we are in a slightly different world here, because they are not truly anonymous, because you have a number associated with the contribution itself. So that I think is one of the wrinkles in trying to understand this. I want to thank you for your answers today. It's been very helpful to understand, since I am not in the aggregating business. And of course, I imagine that many of my personal payments have gone through aggregators unbeknownst to me. So I appreciate your answers on that, and I look forward to the written answers to some of the questions that we've asked you here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I, too, am on draft B, but I anticipate that we'll probably have some revisions to the draft based on some of the things that you've said today, and probably in response to some of the items that you'll be sending in to us. But since we've agreed not to vote today, I will take this time to thank you very much for coming in to both of you. This was a very helpful conversation.
Thank you.
And we will reconsider this issue at the next open meeting.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-20. Mark Wayne Mullen. We have with us today Mr. Jason Torchinski and Sean Sheehy. Please feel free to join us. Ms. Selenkoff, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 12-38 responds to an advisory opinion request by Mark Wayne Mullen. Mr. Mullen is a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives and is also the president, CEO, and sole shareholder of Mullen Plumbing Incorporated and Mullen Plumbing West Division Incorporated. Mr. Mullen asks whether radio and television advertisements paid for by the Mullen companies would be electioneering communications when aired within the electioneering communication window. If so, he also asks whether, when he files electioneering communication reports with the Commission, he must disclose the names of the company's customers who paid $1,000 or more for services rendered since January 1, 2011. The draft concludes the advertisements would be electioneering communications. The draft further concludes that Mr. Mullen will not be required to disclose the names of the customers of the company's customers. The Commission received one comment from the requester. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Selenkoff. Any questions or comments? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly sympathetic to the requester and how the law applies to your client. The ads here clearly are for advertising a business. I don't think anybody thinks that they're election related, but how does the law apply to these? When the electioneering communications provision was put into place, it was, I think, hoped that it would primarily capture only those ads that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy, but I think baked into that was that it was going to capture some ads that were either purely issue ads or other types of ads. I believe in Citizens United, I can't remember if it was the first or the second hearing of oral argument in that case. I think it was Justice Alito who brought up the hypothetical about what if Walmart were to be advertising action figure dolls of the presidential candidates. Would that trigger an electioneering communication report? And, one of the issues that was at stake in that case was whether or not there was going to have to be reporting of electioneering communications in the case where the ads at issue were not the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And the court said that no, that's not the case, that they don't need to be the functional equivalent of express advocacy in order to trigger reporting requirements. So in many ways, though I'm very sympathetic with the request and the concern here, as a commissioner, I feel like my hands are tied. I think that the statute does say what it says. In some of these cases, on the MER side of things, in the enforcement context, we have dismissed on prosecutorial discretion grounds complaints that have arisen in this sort of a context where there have been advertisements, where a candidate owns a business. I think there's one that was involving a funeral home where they ran ads within an electioneering communication window. And we dismissed it on prosecutorial discretion grounds. We can do that on the back end. At the front end, when we're having to declare as a matter of law whether or not these are or not electioneering communications, it's difficult. And like I said, I think that our hands are somewhat tied on in this particular area. These do meet the technical definition. And though we are given some discretion to exempt electioneering communications, dealing with commercial transactions, what Congress granted on one hand, they took away a lot of on the other. So I'm reluctantly going to be supporting the draft. Again, I understand the concerns, but I think that the law says what the law says, and so I will support the draft. And at the appropriate time, I'd also like to make a few amendments at the table.
Thank you. Commissioner McGinn.
I think the Act says what it says. Under the plain language of the Act, this ad comes within the reach of that provision. The way I read the request is he's making, I think there's two different arguments. One is we do have the statutory authority to have carve-outs of something that would otherwise come within the Act, and the Commission has sort of done that on occasion. And the other is more of a legislative intent that Congress really didn't mean to reach this sort of ad, even though, well, the language they used did. I'm not sure I agree that they didn't intend to reach it. I'm not sure I agree with the opposite proposition. I'm not sure we really know, because the electioneering communication provision was one of these amendments that came in to get the thing passed. And I really think they used a meat cleaver, not a scalpel. And I really, it seems to me they were trying to ban everything. And to the extent they gave the Commission the power to do carve-outs, I think that was a way to protect against an overbreath challenge in court. But it's a troubling request, because you have an ad for a commercial business that's being caught up in the campaign finance regime. This is different than other situations where it's simply the business's name, which also happens to be the same name of a candidate. In the proposed ad, the candidate is actually talking to camera, identifies himself as by name, which seems to me to come squarely within the reach of the Act. Certainly, if I were left to my own devices, I think the law goes too far, and it certainly reaches ads that are not unambiguously campaign-related, but for the fact that the statute requires a targeting component, meaning more than, I think it's 50,000, or it's 50,000 or more. I'd have to pull the Act to see, but the ad has to be able to be viewed by a certain number of voters, so it is tied to at least voters. The most persuasive argument to me for creating an exemption is the result that now you're going to have business ads that have these paid for by the business and authorized by the candidate, and it gets into that mess, and then it eats up time in the ad. Very good arguments for, I think, a court. I'm not sure that's necessarily enough for us to, in an AO, carve out an exception as much as I'd like to. Slightly different facts, I can see a different result, but I guess I have a question for the requester on this. And my concern is, when we deviate from the Act, the Commission hasn't fared well. Sometimes it deviates from the Act and creates more permissive rules. Shays 1, 2, 3, Van Hollen, which is still on appeal, so I don't want to prejudge that one, but Shays 1, 2, and 3 are done. The more common problem is they overread the Act, or they don't realize it's been limited by a court, or that sort of thing. If we start carving out exceptions, help me with the justification. Certainly, the Supreme Court and Citizens United seem to say the government has enough in the government interest bucket to justify these sorts of disclosure obligations. Just because the government can regulate doesn't mean it has to regulate. Congress has given us some discretion to do carve-outs. But my concern is that we get picked off base rewriting the Act, and there's a Shays 4, Van Hollen 2 out there on this particular issue. I don't want to be in a position where we do this, and then this becomes the norm, and then there's a suit down the road, and OGC gets to the podium and the judge says, okay, what's the basis for carving this out? Other than the basis of the statute gives the authority, what if the court says you need some sort of reason to do it?
Commissioner, I think that this was a difficult advisory opinion to decide to submit in the first place, because you know we did have the Rustero AO that said nope, not an electionary communication. We did know about the funeral parlor case where the commission declined in an enforcement action to apply the law and find a violation by a commercial business that advertised. But you know we were trying to be upfront here so that we knew on the front end whether we would have to comply with these disclosure and disclaimer requirements. And you know when you get back to what's the purpose of these disclosures, the purpose of these disclosures is knowing who is behind these ads. Well, if the commission says that I don't have to, you know, that Mullen Plumbing doesn't have to disclose all of its customers, Mullen Plumbing is not hiding from the advertisement. There's no doubt looking at the ad that it's a Mullen Plumbing advertisement. I mean, where's the government interest in basically forcing the plumbing company to reveal its essentially commercial deals for its advertising when it really has absolutely nothing to do with the election? It's the exact same ads that the company's been running for a decade. I mean, I think that the commission can approach this in a very narrow way, which is essentially to say, in this narrow set of circumstances, which is very consistent with a long-standing tradition of the business advertising in the exact same way and not changing its advertising close in time to the election, you know, there is the possibility of a carve-out. I mean, if we had just run the ad and then been here on an enforcement action, it sounds like we might have had a 3-3 split. But, you know, then you put the candidate and the company through, you know, 6 to 18 months of, you know, back and forth and uncertainty with the FEC. And, you know, it just seemed like coming to the commission in the first place and saying, hey, just clarify that, you know, in this narrow set of circumstances, which has occurred, what, 3 times since BCRA was passed in 2002, that, you know, the electionary communication rules really shouldn't apply to what is a bona fide, genuine commercial advertisement.
Do you have any is there anything that you may have found in the legislative history that gives us a sense of what Congress had in mind when they gave the FEC the power to carve things out?
Not really.
Yeah. That's my concern, is the legislative history is not particularly helpful one way or another, because this was one of these sort of package deal that evolved out of Snow Jeffords and all that.
I understand that, but for any disclosure requirement, and let's ignore the fact that essentially the commission would be commandeering 10% of the television ad and 25% of a 60-second radio ad with the disclaimer requirements.
I don't want to interrupt you, but did you say the commission's commandeering?
Well, I mean the statute would be commandeering.
You know, the government is, and we're part of the government, but let's not put all the blame here.
Sorry.
The streets of the White Dome and talk to those who voted for it.
You know, I mean, if you think about it, Mullen Plumbing is responsible for the content of this advertising. That just took me 3 or 4 seconds. In a 30-second radio ad, that's 10%. Mullen Plumbing is responsible for the content of this advertising, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, paid for by Mullen Plumbing Incorporated, mullenplumbing.com. I mean, that just took a good 10 or 15 seconds, which is, you know, potentially up to 25% of even a 60-second radio ad, and God forbid they should want to do a 30-second radio ad, and half their airtime is now taken up by mandated disclaimers that really serve no governmental purpose whatsoever. There's no doubt that Mullen Plumbing is behind these commercial ads.
Right.
And so where's the government interest in requiring a commercial business to then also do not only take up 10% of the television ad and 25% of the radio ad, but also file disclosures that show how much they're paying for their advertising? It's virtually the same subject that is now the subject of the lawsuit by the broadcasters against the FCC about government-mandated disclosure of commercial activity, which really doesn't serve any real purpose.
Oh, that's true. Almost.
Okay.
Except for the last part. I'm not sure we can say it doesn't serve any governmental purpose. It may not be a sufficient governmental purpose. It may not be tailored to the sufficient narrowness that one needs to justify it, but I don't think you can say there's not any purpose, particularly when the Citizens United folks brought essentially the same argument to the Supremes, and they said, well, there still is this interest of the voters' right to know. Now, I understand that those were ads about a movie that was the functional equivalent of express advocacy. But they made the same sort of argument that, geez, it's 15, we're going to do 15-second ads, and how do we have all these disclaimers and all this stuff, and you know, beats me why they upheld it, because I thought at a certain point the ad's so short and the disclaimers are so long, it seems to eat up a lot of the ad. But so far that hasn't worked out. Now, that doesn't mean the commission still doesn't retain the statutory ability to carve stuff out. It does from time to time. But again, I'm concerned. Let's assume this is a rulemaking, and it wasn't. Let's say we pass a rule that says exactly what you want us to do here, and then there's a lawsuit saying that we weren't justified. My concern is I'm not hearing the real good argument other than, well, the Congress gave us the authority and these don't pass, so maybe that's enough.
The statutory authority granted to the commission permits the commission through regulation to grant an exception as long as the ad doesn't pass any candidate. I mean, that's what the statute says. The fact that the commission has so far declined to issue that regulation, you know, is troubling. But, you know, given that the commission has, you know, in at least one advisory opinion asserted that authority in the absence of a regulation, and in an enforcement action declined to move forward on a case that was, you know, if you take a strict reading of the law, which it sounds like at least two commissioners think would have been the case had the respondent in that MER come to the commission in advance, you know, would have gotten an opinion that said no, you know, you had to comply. You know, it's sort of tough to say, okay, well, because you asked instead of acting first, we're not going to give you the same exceptions that we've given the other two in the last 12 years that have come in before, last 10 years that have come before the commission with the exact same circumstance.
Address, I can anticipate a concern that some would raise. Your case seems easy. You have a company, they've done previous ads. The guy's talking to camera who's a candidate, but he's talking on behalf of the business. There's nothing in the ad that's campaign related whatsoever, but for the fact the act essentially says it is, because it's going to a certain number of voters and the guy happens to be running. What about the argument that some will make, that, well, this is some loophole, and why wouldn't candidates just do this sort of thing all the time, and what if it's the first time they're doing an ad for a business and all that sort of thing? How do we grapple with that? Because it's an issue that's come up in some of these now publicly available MERS they've done this ad before. What if you haven't done the ad before? Why is that significant? It makes it easier to get you a yes, but help me think through.
This was also an issue in the Heart of America restaurants complaint from a couple of years ago, where Dave Whalen, who was the restaurant owner, was in the restaurant ads, you know, all over the area that happened to be the district. And that wasn't an electionary communications question, because we weren't inside the windows. It was a coordination question. You know, in the coordination area, and the reason that we don't think that, you know, running these ads, even if they constitute ECs, you know, constitute a coordinated contribution to the campaign, is, you know, in the coordination section, the commission has very clearly laid out a commercial advertising exception. The commission didn't decline for some reason not to do the same thing in the electionary communications context. So I guess in my view,
it's a different issue, though, isn't it? Because if your business, your for-profit corporate business, gets caught if all of a sudden this business ad becomes coordinated, it's then prohibited, it becomes a speech ban.
Well, the same thing
is the electionary communication regime, although burdensome, is not a per se ban. It could chill to the point of causing issues, but it's I could see why that it's not that the commission forgot to do the EC thing. I mean, it's two different.
It is, yeah, but
related
it,
concepts.
Right. I mean, and the reason that we didn't ask about whether this would be a coordinated ad is because the coordination regulations have the commercial exception. But, you know, we're in this weird spot where it's not a coordinated communication, so it's not an in-kind contribution to the campaign, but yet we still have to comply with all these disclosure and disclaimer requirements that kind of suggest that it is. I mean, the candidate's going to be in the ad, and the ad's going to say not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. I mean, it's kind of a weird the statutory scheme is weird, but in this particular case, the application of it is kind of absurd.
So is the gist of the request you don't want to do an EC report, or the disclaimers and the actual content of the ad? You're looking for a way to get guidance on what the disclaimer ought to be. I know we have MERS where this has come up that are public, where you may have a candidate in the context of party committees, and is it, you know, do they have to say it's approved by the candidate? Once they say that, that makes it look like a coordinated. And that's actually more confusing to the public than if it's just paid for by the company, which obviously it is paid for by the company, because who else would pay for the company's ad but the company ad? Are you looking to just knock off some of the disclaimers and tighten them up so that it doesn't really step all over your ad?
In my ideal world, I would love for the commission to say, in this context, you know, in there's an exception just like there is for Restaro, and there's no EC here. If there's no EC, then there's no concern about the disclaimers, then there's no concern about the 48-hour disclosures, and there's no concern about, you know, the last question where the commission is being asked to address, you know, some issues that are pending in the D.C. Circuit, you know, kind of early in the, and while the litigation is pending. So, in some ways, it would be really easy for the court, for the commission to say, in this particular set of circumstances, in this narrow area, we're going to, you know, permit Mark Wayne Mullen to do the same thing that we permitted Restaro to do, and the same thing that we, you know, declined to enforce in the funeral home case. And that would be a really short way to just address this one issue. I mean, you know, otherwise my client's going to be in the position of, in the next 48 hours, having to decide to either, you know, rewrite his ads, you know, find somebody to host his Saturday morning radio show instead of him, consider going to court and see whether he wants to seek an injunction prohibiting enforcement actions against Mullen Plumbing. I mean, to do this opinion as it's drafted, you know, puts my client in a very awkward position in the next 48 hours and you know, potentially, you know, embroils the commission in some litigation over this.
Awesome.
Thanks, Don.
I mean, that's my point. Maybe that's really where this needs to go.
I'd be happy to negotiate a consent decree with the commission and go forward with a consent decree over it. If that would resolve it. I don't know the commission's ever done that, but
I think it's had the options over the years, but declined. And
I, like I said, I don't think the commission's ever done it. But I wouldn't be opposed to it.
At least not voluntarily. All right, you had the situation in the other AO where it's the name of the business and the candidate's not talking to camera.
I believe that in that case, the candidate was the founder of the business.
Right.
Right, and it was named after him.
Right.
Okay.
Or something like that.
Right.
Here you have your guy, the candidate, talking to camera.
Whose dad founded the business.
Okay. If some of us think there's a distinction between the two of those, tell me why that's wrong.
The difference is he's not appearing in this ad in his capacity as a candidate. In other words, you know, it's pretty clear that people can wear – I mean, in campaign finance law, it's pretty clear that people can wear multiple hats, you know, state party chairs, you know, federal officials can have, you know, sort of personal capacities and public capacities. In this case, he's not appearing in this ad because he is a candidate. He's appearing in this ad because for 10 years, you know – I'm Mark Wayne Mullen of Mullen Plumbing has been the voice of this large plumbing company in Oklahoma for a decade. He's not appearing in this ad because he's a candidate. And he doesn't even mention or refer to the candidacy in the ad. So unless you knew that he was running for office, you wouldn't even know that he's running for Congress.
And let me ask you this. There was a time way back in the day where when it was identifying a federal candidate meant you actually had to say the guy was a candidate. The commission moved beyond that. I think Congress moved beyond that with the electioneering communication regime, where it's not the subjective impression on the viewer whether someone knows this guy's a candidate. There's an objective trigger. The guy's either a candidate or he's not because he's filed paperwork with the FEC or, you know, taking steps to get on a ballot and all that, you know. So it's not that, well, no one knows he's a candidate. If we start getting into that sort of thing, aren't we sort of conveniently creating vagueness in a regime that, for what you want to say about the electioneering communication regime, it's clear, right? I mean, it's bright line timing. Guy has to be a candidate, certain number of voters. I mean, they went out of their way to use the sort of very, very blunt meat cleaver to carve very bright lines. And I hear you that he's not appearing as a candidate. And to this sort of reasonable viewer test, yeah, I get it. That's his business. Everybody knows it's his business. But doesn't the statute still reach that? I think it does. And are we getting into an issue of what really is identification of a federal candidate in this AO? I didn't think we were getting to that issue today.
Well, I don't think you need to get to that issue today. I mean, I think you could sort of issue a very narrow advisory opinion that simply says, in this circumstance, this advertisement is not an electioneering communication, and be done. I really think the commission has the power to do that.
And when you say in this circumstance, you mean because he's been doing this in the past? I mean, we couldn't obviously just grant the request just to this one person. But the factual part that you're narrowing it down to is he's been doing this long before he ever decided to run.
Correct. He's been doing it for long before he's ever decided to run. The volume of advertising is not changing during the time period where he is a candidate. I mean,
Worry about the next guy or not. The facts in this case are you have a history of this commercial advertising at this sort of point level, this sort of script, this guy talking to camera.
That's
whether
correct.
Or not the next guy comes in and doesn't have the same point level or the same history, different AO, this is, you know, if you have the same facts, you're going to be protected by this AO if we say yes.
You know, I mean, if Sean Sheehy Ford, you know, Sean, my colleague sitting here, I mean, if Sean Sheehy had been advertising his Ford dealership for 20 years and decided to run for Congress and had always been in every ad, then and they weren't changing the volume of their advertising and their advertising was consistent with what it had been for 20 years. Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a unique advisory opinion request because I don't think these specific facts are likely to recur very often. I mean, in the 10 years since this statute's been here, there have been three instances in front of the commission. There was the Rustaro, there was the funeral home, and now there's this one. That's three in 10 years out of hundreds, maybe possibly thousands of candidates for federal office that have been candidates over the last decade.
If you believe the newspapers, a gazillion dollars.
Potentially, yeah.
One final question. You mentioned hosting the show. Talk about that for a minute, just refresh my memory.
It's one of those Saturday morning sponsored radio programs. You know, the company for a decade has paid the radio station X dollar amount for that hour every Saturday morning, and he talks about home improvement things like how to make sure your pipes aren't going to burst and, you know, whatever else. I mean, it's an hour of Mark Wayne Mullen talking about home improvement projects.
Does media exemption protect that?
You know, I mean, I don't know because in this case, the entity that's purchasing the time is owned or controlled by the candidate. So I'm not sure that it's protected by the media exemption.
Okay. It's a TV show.
It's radio.
Radio show. Sounds like media.
Could be. but it's owned or controlled by the candidate. I mean, it is the candidate's company that's paying for the advertising.
That's true. Kind of like Steve Forbes owned Forbes magazine, and the commission thought they could go after him for coordination with his op-eds, but then the suit was eventually dropped. So
right.
I'm not sure simply because you also – I mean, I could see sort of Citizen Kane, too, you know, buying every TV station and propping themselves up, and that may go beyond traditional media, but – I'm fishing for a yes here, Jason.
I hear you.
I'm asking media exemption. The answer is yes. or help me say, you know, advocate here. Help me out. I mean, is there? So you don't think that works either?
Well, I mean,
maybe it works. Maybe
look, I mean, I guess if I were going to try to put this under the media exemption, I would say Mullen Plumbing and not Mark Wayne Mullen is purchasing the advertising. You know, it's a corporate entity that's actually purchasing the advertising. It's just consistently had Mark Wayne Mullen as a guest.
So remind me, Mr. Torchinsky, you brought up some information and made us sort of, rethink voting for this draft. What is the deadline for this one, if council could remind us?
The election is June 26th, and the 30-day period begins, I believe, May 27th, because there's 31 days in May. So I believe it. You know, this goes into effect over the holiday weekend.
Okay, so what? I don't have my calendar in front of me. What's the date of this coming Tuesday?
This coming Tuesday is the 29th, I believe.
Okay.
So we'll be 2 days into the electioneering communications period. So it won't affect this Saturday's radio show, but it will affect next Saturday's radio show.
Would it be possible to get a bit of an extension from you to consider this And I'm trying to, I mean, if we give you an answer by next Tuesday, it doesn't help you for the Saturday's radio show, but I don't know if you have any advertisements running between now and...
This Saturday's radio show won't be affected because this Saturday's radio show is the 26th.
Okay.
So it's actually outside the window. But I can find out what advertisements are planned for Sunday and Monday over the holiday weekend. But, you know, the disclosure requirements don't go into effect until we've spent $10,000.
Okay.
I mean, given that we're only spending about $40,000 a month, I don't think in 2 days we would exceed the $10,000 threshold.
Well, if you could let us know, we can take a brief recess or a recess for as long as you need to determine whether or not you're able to give us an extension till Tuesday or Wednesday of next week.
We will, yes, we can take a brief recess. We'll contact the client.
Okay. Thank you. And Commissioner McGann has another comment, but before we get to that, Mr. Torchinsky, you were able to talk to your client about whether or not we could seek an extension.
Yes, we can grant an extension until Wednesday the 30th. The client does not run advertising on Sundays, and the Monday-Tuesday spending will not exceed $10,000, so if we get an answer that we're looking for
by Wednesday,
would be what
you
we are.
I apologize. Commissioner Bowerly wasn't in the room. When I looked over, you were, so I apologize. You must have left after I looked over.
Okay.
Weren't you in here just a couple seconds ago?
I was not here when you started the meeting.
Okay, you were here, and I saw you, so I apologize for not seeing you leave. Could you repeat that?
Sure. We consulted with the client during the break, and the client does not run advertising on Sundays, and the Monday-Tuesday advertising will not exceed $10,000, so we can grant an extension until Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you very much. We
sure.
appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner McGann?
Just a final point. It's amazing what you learn when you actually pull a statute off the shelf. The exemption, the statutory, we've talked about the statutory power of the commission to exempt things. What the statute actually says is any other communication exempted under such regulation as the commission may promulgate consistent with the requirements of this paragraph to ensure the appropriate implementation of this paragraph, except that under any such regulation, a communication may not be exempted if it meets the requirements of this paragraph and is described in Section 301 with the subparts, which is now 2 U.S.C. 431.28.3. The statute expressly talks about regulation. AOs are also a creature of the statute. My concern is if Congress meant to let us do it AO by AO, they would have said AO. I don't think AOs and regs are synonymous in the statute. I think they're two different creatures.
Commissioner, I agree with you, but I would draw your attention to page 4 of the Rust-Darrow opinion. The commission said, the decision not to adopt a blanket exemption for such communications, however, does not preclude the commission from making a determination that the specific facts and circumstances of a particular case indicate that certain advertisements do not refer to a clearly identified federal candidate and hence do not constitute electioneering communications. So,
familiar with it. I had it in front of me because I think it's in your request.
Yes.
It absolutely says that. That doesn't contradict what I just said the statute says, because in Darrow, the commission said that wasn't clearly identifying a federal candidate. So Darrow never got within the reach of the Electioneering Communication Act to begin with. Commission never reached the exemption part. So, you know, there's a distinction. If Darrow would have said it's an EC, but we're going to exempt it out, then I see your point. But the Darrow AO didn't say that. The Darrow AO said Darrow wasn't even within the EC thing. Now, that's why I was fishing earlier for are we going to say that a candidate talking to camera is not clearly identifying a federal candidate because he never actually says I'm a candidate. Once upon a time, I thought there was the reg's been modified, and it's really not the EC reg; it's more the other regs. But
the clearly identified candidate regulation at 100.17.
If you speak reg speak. I'll take your word for
yeah.
that. I don't speak numbers, I speak concepts. So clearly identified candidate, that reg doesn't require you to say you're a candidate. Right?
That's correct.
Right. So just so you sort of know where we're coming down, I'm in play, but what Commissioner Peterson said makes a lot of sense, because I'm not sure, even though we have some authority, I'm not sure that the statute gives us the authority to do it in an AO. I wish we could, but what I will say is you got a great set of facts for a test case, and Godspeed on that front, because you know, look, the statute says what it says. I mean, but it is. I mean, I hear the argument you're making, but I think this is what Congress did. I think they swept a lot of stuff in. Business, not business, you know, and if the commission can do it through a reg with notice, comment, rulemaking, four votes and all that, then they can give you permission to do what you want to do. And I put the permission in scare quotes. That's the way McCain-Feingold set up. It's not based upon the idea you can do what you want unless it's prohibited. It inverts the what I think is the proper analysis. But that's a concern with the statute itself. So to the extent you drop in other comments or what you want to do to try to figure out where the votes are ahead of time, that's my problem is I've tied so much of what I've done at the commission to language in the act. Some people would say sometimes I've sliced the act a little too thin, but I've always tried to tie it to the act. And now I'm looking at the act, and I don't see a lot of room to run. And if there is room that I'm missing, legislative intent, or whatever, I'm all ears. But I can't deviate from clear language of the statute unless there's some notion that regulation and AOs are interchangeable, and I'm not sure I buy that either. But if there's something else out there, that's to the extent you want to, as I said in the other AO, bait the hook, that's my hang up.
Okay, I understand.
Mr. Herman?
Mr. Torshinsky, if I understand the request, Mr. Mullen has been running these sorts of TV and radio ads for about a decade, about 10 years.
Sean, correct? Yes, correct.
And I take it that the content of the ads will not change between now and the election.
That is correct.
Do you think that Congress intended to sweep in these sorts of ads into the electioneering communication statute?
I don't believe so, and I also believe that as a constitutional matter, as Commissioner McGann said, I don't think that even the disclosure regimes that the courts have laid out, the exacting scrutiny standard could cover this.
But you don't think Congress intended to sweep this sort of advertisement into?
I don't think Congress ever even considered this. When Congress passed BICR in the first place, they flat prohibited corporations from engaging in electioneering communications, and I don't think that Congress ever intended to ban bona fide commercial advertisements. There was no indication in the statute that banning bona fide commercial advertisements was part of the BICR Section 203 ban on corporate expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Torshinsky.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the extension.
Thank you.
Okay, we will move on to the next matter on the agenda. Well, I'll just note that the Legacy Committee, Political Action Committee audit was held over to the next public meeting. And so the next matter on the agenda is the National Right to Life Political Action Committee, A09-19.
Okay. The document in front of you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on National Right to Life PAC. And in that document are the recommendations of the Audit Division for the proposed final audit report. In finding one, the Misstatement of Financial Activity, the audit staff recommends that the Commission find that NRL PAC misstated its financial activity for calendar years 2007 and 2008. And the committee has filed corrective amendments that set the public record straight on this finding. And I just want to note that at the audit hearing we had in February, the committee provided an explanation for what happened with this, and that explanation will be included in the proposed final audit report as well. And finding two, disclosure of occupation and name of employer. The audit staff on this finding recommends that the commission remove this finding from the PFAR. And the reason that we're making that recommendation at this point in time is that during the fieldwork, the committee provided several letters showing that they had requested information, but we had a problem with documenting the follow-up efforts in this regard. But at the audit hearing, the committee explained to us that on their receipts data file, there was a column that they entered information requested each time a letter was sent. So in conjunction with that and with the letters, we made a decision that they had met the best efforts requirement, and that's why we're recommending that this finding be removed at this point in time. And the other issue that we're discussing in the memorandum is the scope limitation. And what we tried to do here was we tried to be a little bit more specific about what we were missing and why we needed it for our testing. The scope limitation is basically about the records related to independent expenditures and debts. And as far as independent expenditures, as the counsel for the committee discussed at the hearing, they had provided 83% of the affidavits and associated documents. But the problem that we had was we weren't always able to tell what the dissemination dates were or what candidates were involved based on our review of the affidavits. And as far as the debts are concerned, without invoices, we couldn't tell when debts were incurred, and therefore we weren't able to complete our testing of debts. And we'd be glad to answer any questions you have on these matters.
Thank you. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I appreciate you recommending to remove finding two. I agree with that conclusion, and this is the occupation and employer best efforts. I don't really agree with the reason why. I think the database is somewhat of a red herring. Best efforts requires that you put the requisite language or something close to the requisite language on the response device, and then you need to send a follow-up letter. And my understanding is in the past, if a committee could show you sample response devices and a sample letter that they say was sent, that would satisfy best efforts. And I think that's happened here. So although it's not really an issue because the finding, I guess, is going to go away, for me, it doesn't go away because of the database and, to quote the memo, in addition to the significant number of follow-up letters sent by the ones they did prove. I think it's much simpler than that. I made this point in the hearing on this when counsel for this committee was here. But I do appreciate the fact that the finding, we don't have to fight over whether it should be in or out. The material misstatement finding, I just want to state this so the committee understands where I'm coming from. As I understand it, the cash on hand is not quite right. There's a receipt issue and a disbursement issue. On the disbursement issue, as I understand it, the committee made disbursements to folks to do probably independent expenditures, but at the time they made it, they really weren't sure. They did the independent expenditure reports properly around the time of the dissemination, but the cash on hand's off because they didn't do negative entries to offset all that, so it looked like the money went out the door twice.
Correct.
Okay. This is the kind of thing that then the issue really isn't the cash on hand, because the cash on hand mistake is really a result of a much larger mistake, which is not doing the negative entries, which, unless you are a pretty good accountant or think in those terms, it's not something that you would necessarily pick up on. But it seems to me it's the same mistake made over and over and over again. It's whether it's $1 or $1 million, the issue is that they didn't make the negative entries, not that they went off and had cash on hand all over the place because of a multitude of issues. It's all tied back to the same issue. The scope limitation, we talked about this previously when counsel for the committee was here, or we talked about it with him, and we, I think the auditors were involved in the discussion. I still don't understand the scope limitation where the initial sentence says that National Right to Life PAC, NLR PAC, satisfied the minimum record-keeping requirements for 11 CFR 102.9 concerning disbursements, and then says, however, and then there's this limitation about how they didn't really have enough records. I'm not sure how this works. Just as an aside, when it's satisfied the minimum record keeping, is there a maximum record keeping? I mean, I guess that's your standard language, but it's not really a range. I mean, they either satisfied the record keeping in the reg or they didn't. I never see a statement that says they did a really good job or the auditors found that they were well above the minimum. It's either they did or they didn't. But once they do that, I'm not sure we can then continue to say that there may be some issues. It's just we're not too sure because they didn't have invoices. The stuff that's remaining, meaning the disbursements, how do we know that those are independent expenditures? Is it that somewhere on the report they said that, or have they proffered that orally, or is that on an invoice somewhere?
Probably a little bit of all of the above. I think it's reports and the documents that we did have to review.
Okay. Well, if it's a little bit of all of the above, how much is it based on the reports or actual?
Yeah,
my concern is that we're presuming something may be an IE unless they have documentation to show it's not an IE.
Correct.
And if that's what this limitation really means, then I can't support it because that seems to be something that comes up time and time again in audit where it ends up being, well, we didn't really have the document, so we're still going to say that maybe they have a problem, even though we don't have the predicate fact to say that there's even a problem. It seems like we're making a jump to presuming that this is something that maybe should have had a separate IE report, but because they can't prove there isn't, that it's not an IE. But they don't have to keep a script because the record-keeping reg doesn't require that kind of content.
Right. I think the reason we use minimum requirements for 102.9 is basically all they're required to have is a canceled check. And all the other information that we need to see to verify other information is not really a requirement of the record-keeping regulation. So that's probably why we use the term minimum, meaning that they had what was necessary to meet that requirement. But in completing our other testing, it's important, like for dissemination dates, that we're able to independently verify, you know, what that date is on the notices. And in a lot of cases, with the documentation that we had presented to us, we weren't able to make those calls. And that's, you know, as a result of that is why we do a scope limitation. We're just saying, you know, we weren't able to conclusively say that all the dissemination dates were correct on the notices. However, the record-keeping requirements were met by the committee.
Why couldn't we do a tighter limitation, keep the first sentence, says they satisfied the minimum record-keeping requirements, and then say this audit is limited by a review of these records or limited to the review of, instead of spelling out in detail in a way that I think makes it look like they still may have an issue, which I, based upon the discussion we had with the counsel for the committee, I don't think they do. I mean, is there a way to tighten this up?
I think we can work on something in that regard, absolutely. So I guess what you're suggesting is that by having this much detail, it makes it look more like there's been a violation? Is that
precisely
where you're coming from?
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And a final question, and I guess I'm saying this really to be nice. I understand the auditor on this is out, and there's someone that's sick, so I understand that we're pinch hitting today, so that's why I'm not pressing too hard because this scope issue is an issue that transcends just this audit. With the scope limitation, is there a standard process you have as to what you use in standard language and without getting into what we may deem confidential? My concern is that this may be sort of fluid, or is there a standard, or is this a know it when you see it kind of thing?
Well,
or is it somewhere
we,
between the two extremes?
We do have a materiality threshold.
Okay.
that.
I understand that as to whether, that's well known, and now the public can not see what the dollar numbers are, but they know that there are such things.
Right.
So if it's something that's not material, it doesn't go in. That's for a finding. But for purposes of the limitation.
I don't think we really have a standard blurb that we use, although, you know, we try to be as consistent as we can be when we, we write one.
Okay.
And in all honesty, most of the scope limitations are usually related to debts because of invoice, you know, dates that we don't have. We don't know when the debts are incurred. So that's probably been the most common one over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have some on independent expenditures occasionally, like in this case.
Yes, what I wanted to add was we've had a couple scope limitations on the 2008 cycle reports, and it's similar. It's not the same because, like you said, those scope limitations did not deal with independent expenditures. These dealt with debt reporting or verifying the adequacy of the information because maybe in those cases we only had canceled checks. You know, you can't.
Got it. Okay.
And I also wanted to add previously to something you said earlier about on the misstatement that you know, how would committees know how to report that, you know, if they make a payment ahead of the dissemination date?
Mm-hmm.
That information, although not contained in the regs, is contained in the line-by-line instructions for the FEC Form 3X.
Okay. All right. Read the form. The final part of the limitation, the one suggestion I'd make is to try to get a little more standardization of this because I think, and, you know, you're not necessarily – you're just part of the larger team, but it seems to me that at a certain point somebody's going to say audit's not necessarily doing it the same every time, and I see these things kind of floating around, so I think that that's something that may be helpful because then otherwise we're going to look at this each and every time, and there becomes a standard scope that we can agree on. That should save everybody time, and we can get on with our lives and all that. Let me ask a final question, though, about the last bit of the limitation. Where it says, to verify the accuracy of debt reporting, the audit staff needed dated invoices to determine whether they were required to be disclosed as a debt based on the dates of incurrence noted on the invoices. Okay, I guess that's okay as far as it goes, but let's turn it around. You don't have any information that shows what they reported is inaccurate. You just can't, as an auditor, vouch for its accuracy.
That's correct.
Okay, so...
So where there were invoices, we were able to verify that the debts were reported accurately, where we where we could tell when it had been incurred.
Okay.
But for the ones that we didn't have, we were unable to test that.
Right.
And that's why we note this as a scope limit.
All right. But you don't have any information that says it was wrong. It could be it was like the stuff you tested ends up being correct.
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments on this audit? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No questions, just a brief comment that I also would support a tightening of this, not only a more standardization, but a kind of a tighter scope of limitation in this report as well.
So does the audit staff agree it's probably best to recirculate something with some change of the language that we've discussed? Commissioner Bowerly?
I think we have done in other instances where this is the recommendation memo and what will come from this is the proposed final. Thank you. That given the discussion of the table, we can ask them to proceed as we've discussed, approve this memorandum with the discussion at the table, and then obviously we'll get another draft for our review and approval.
That works. Thank you.
I believe we need a vote on this.
I was waiting for someone to. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, I think it's important that we have some indication in here as to what the auditors looked at and what they didn't. So I appreciate having the scope limitation, but I don't. I hear what my colleagues say, and I don't disagree that it would be good to have sort of standard language and. I see no problem with tightening it up in this instance. So with that, I move that we approve the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the National Right to Life Political Action Committee, AO9-19, set forth in agenda document number 12-35, and direct the staff to proceed in accordance with the discussion at the table.
Thank you. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. I believe, Madam Vice Chair, we have a late submitted document.
We have another late submitted document.
I'll take that back from you,
Rita. Yes, I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-40.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. And the document that we were talking about is the rulemaking priorities for 2012 and additional rulemaking projects, which is a list that we've compiled. It's been a joint effort, and I believe we have all six commissioners who are intending to vote for this document. The purpose of it, obviously, is to tell the public, you know, what rules we're working on here at the building. We have two priorities for 2012, the independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations, which is inspired by the petition filed by the James Madison Center for Free Speech following the Citizens United decision. And we anticipate having a final rule on that this calendar year. With regard to the political committees that engage in independent spending rulemaking, which we used to call the Speech Now / Emily's List rulemaking, that one we are working on and hope to have some progress on that as well this year. There's some additional rulemaking projects that we will, that many members of the staff will be working on, not necessarily simultaneously, but when they have some time away from AOs and other work, they'll be working on these issues. So, thank you very much to my colleagues for working all together to come up with a list that I think we can all agree on. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a little bit surprised to see my name on the document. I didn't know it was coming from me. But I completely agree that these top two under rulemaking priorities for 2012 have to be our first priorities. And then there are a lot of projects on here that I know, you know, different commissioners might rate them in different orders, but, you know, I think there's some agreement that these are all projects that would be worthwhile doing. So with that, unless there are any further comments, I move that we approve agenda document number 12-40, the rulemaking priorities for 2012.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Just a couple of really quick announcements, if I might. I just wanted to make mention that the FEC released many documents yesterday in response to a House oversight hearing that was held on November 3rd of last year. The enforcement documents, the reports analysis division procedures, and the audit division materials are all now available on our website. We issued a press release yesterday regarding this with some names of people in the staff. If you the public has questions, feel free to call them. Additionally, there's a mailbox that people can use to submit general questions or comments about the documents that were released. And we will have a public hearing to discuss enforcement issues and the documents on September 12th of this year. Wanted to say Madam Vice Chair.
Sorry, I know you're trying to do that quickly, but I did have a couple of comments on that. We've kind of opened up the closets and emptied out the drawers and put it all out on the website, and there are now hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents. But I'm not actually sure. You know, it's fine for us to put it out there. I'm not sure who's going to read them all, but I'm not sure how useful this set of documents is ultimately going to be, for a couple of reasons. One is that they were written for internal consumption. They were written for the staff of this agency. They weren't written with an eye toward making them accessible to the public. So there wasn't a lot of concern with writing in plain English. There's a lot of what we call FEC speak in there. It's kind of jargon heavy. So I think, you know, some people might read some of these things and say, huh, what does that mean? There's also a lot of old documents on there in this collection. There are documents that were old when I got here, so that's a sign of how really old they are. And while, you know, some people might find it interesting to know what the then general counsel thought was a good procedure to follow in 1997, I don't think there's any member of the commission who feels that we are in any way bound to follow those procedures now. I think that there's a much more useful enterprise that's ongoing, and that is the drafting of a current enforcement manual, and I think we're all looking forward to that document. And I think it's great that we're having a hearing coming up. I hope that we can. If people want to talk about the old documents, I suppose we could. But I think a more useful function for that hearing would be to focus on how the commission is organized today, how it's operating today, and how it should be operating going forward. And on the topic of enforcement, which I think is a really important topic for us to be constantly looking at, I think it's important for us to look not only at procedures and manuals, but also on outcomes. And I hope that we'll get a lot of good comments from members of the public, hopefully more than the usual 12 election lawyers in Washington that we rely on so heavily, who always show up on how the agency is doing its job, both whether we are acting in a manner that is fair and also in a manner that is effective in our important role of enforcing the law.
Thank you. Any other comments? I wanted to say thank you to the Information Division for an excellent conference season this year. We just finished up, we had a conference in Miami in February and just finished up three seminars yesterday that were well received, and the registration were sold out even before the registration deadline. So we're very excited about that. And in addition, this was the first time that we offered the programs through a webinar. So obviously people who aren't able to come to Washington can also participate. So thank you very much to Greg Scott and his staff for having an excellent conference season. And if anybody doesn't have any other comments on that, my last comment is to thank you very much to Troy McCurry. This is his last day at the commission and his last public meeting. He will be leaving us to go on to bigger and better things. He's worked here with Commissioner Peterson, Commissioner McGann, and me for the past 2 years, and he's brought a vast array of previous experience to us that's been incredibly helpful. He's worked in the National Party and on campaigns and recounts, and so having that experience here was invaluable to us. He's also a professor at the university, or an adjunct professor at the university, Catholic University Law School, teaches election law, so maybe some of his experiences here will help him as a professor at Catholic. And we'll miss him very much, and he's headed back to the Republican National Committee. That's my last announcement. Does anybody have anything else? This meeting? Oh, Ms. Carmona, are there any management and administrative matters to discuss?
There are none.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Wow.